Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the African Knowledge Gun and Book Club. I'm your host, moderator, Charles Williams. I'm joined by my lovely wife, Jalavette. Say hello, Jalavette.
Hello, Jalavette.
All right. Having a good time. How you doing today?
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. I am very, very excited today for this second discussion with Brother Perry. I am just eager to hear more of the information that he shares so passionately with us.
Right, and if you didn't tune in last week, please go back and listen to the previous podcast. We'll have Dr. Jeffrey B. Perry, the independent working class scholar and world-renowned literary historian and author of the two-volume work titled Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1887 to 1927, sorry. But we discussed a lot of amazing details about how Huey Harrison was actually redefining the Negro agenda, setting a new platform for the next, you know, for the next 100 years. And it was an amazing agenda for us to be more critical of how we're being governed, and whether it's in this diaspora, actually.
Right.
And so we'll let Dr. Perry pick up where we left off last week. We were wrapping up. We were talking about the industrial workers of the world and Harrison's exit from the Socialist Party and those sorts of things. And hello, Dr. Perry. Thank you for joining us again.
Hello. It's certainly my pleasure. Thank you both so much.
Welcome, welcome.
In the Harrison biography, when I speak, I cite comments from both Hubert Harrison from St. Croix, Marcus Garvey from Jamaica, and Claude McKay from Jamaica, a lot of those early 20th century Afro-Caribbean immigrants, and how they encounter such a shock when they come to the U.S. in terms of what is sometimes called, and I put it in quotes, race relations, right? And
mm-hmm.
McKay framed it extremely well, I think. Harrison used the word shocked. He actually used the word shocked. McKay writes that when he came to the U.S., he encountered racial hatred far more bitter than anything he ever imagined, right, here in the U.S. It's a marked contrast from what he knew back in Jamaica. And, again, so many of those early Afro-Caribbean immigrants commented similarly, and I think it's got to do with much that Alan gets into discussing in his book on the invention of the white race. It has to do in large part with how social control is maintained, and it's somewhat differently in the Anglo-American plantation colonies, Virginia, Maryland, what we now know as the U.S., and down in the Caribbean. The English-speaking Caribbean in particular is what Alan's contrasting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I specify about that difference because I think it's very important. But does that answer your question a little bit?
Yes, absolutely.
Charles, would you like me
no,
to just...
No, go ahead.
On the difference in the social control, and I think this is important because it gets into when Harrison, when we were talking last week and Harrison leaves the Socialists, Hubert Harrison leaves the Socialist Party, he offers what I think is arguably the most profound but least heeded criticism in the history of the left, if you will, and that's why it's really unfortunate we didn't know more about him for much of these past 100 years. But Harrison says that the white socialists and the white labor movement put the white race first before class. That's very profound because it leads directly to the question, what is this white race thing that they're, you know, putting first? And that's where Alan's work becomes very important. Now, Alan's thesis, if you will, and I'll lay this out in about 2 minutes, and then I want to get directly to what we're talking about again. Alan writes for on the back of Alan's two-volume work, The Invention of the White Race, first came out in 1994 and 1997. New editions came out in 2012, for which I wrote all the new front matter and back matter and internal study guides and greatly expanded index. And I have a video, a slide presentation video of about 2 hours on my webpage, which is attracting a lot of attention recently, I've been seeing. And it's on his work on the invention of the white race. One set of his main theses, because there's actually a number of theses that he elaborates, is the following. When the first Africans arrive in Virginia in 1619, there were no white people there, nor would there be for another 60 years. And to back this statement up, he does several things. One, he points out, and Virginia is the pattern-setting plantation colony. I think seven of the first 12 presidents come from Virginia eventually, right? And in Virginia, the word white does not appear in a colonial record until 1691. People might be described, the Europeans might be described as English or Irish or Scotch or Dutch or something like that, but they're not described as white. But it's not simply that. Alan argues that the white race as we know it was not functioning. And he goes through lots of things to show that this so-called, this white, multi-class white solidarity against black people, against Africans and African Americans was not, in effect, essentially. And very importantly, he points out, and most people don't know it, unfortunately, if they're brought up in this country with our typical education, but there were many examples of normal class standing for African Americans in this period, things including land holding, property holding, rights to testify in court, et cetera, the right to vote if you had property. Another important distinction he calls to the fore is, I know when I went to school, I was taught right from the beginning, white indentured servitudes and black slaves. But Alan points out, an indenture is a contract that somebody signs, you know, and the European Americans who were chattel bond servants who could be bought and sold in Virginia, the majority of them were not signing indentures, you know, willingly signing themselves into chattel bondage. It was a status that really didn't exist in England, and essentially it was being imposed in the continental Anglo-American plantation colonies. And again, for much of the 17th century, the African Americans in Virginia were not enslaved. They might have been chattel bond servants of a certain period of time, and we'll get into some examples. But so Alan's three theses, his three first set of main theses are the white race did not exist. Two, there was tremendous solidarity, particularly in the period after 1660 when the price of tobacco falls, and is a struggle from below between, including laboring people and bond servants, European American and African American. And let me just also point out what Alan's describing about conditions in 17th century Virginia through much of that century, the similarity of conditions for laboring class and European Americans, you will also find in the very wonderful work of Lerone Bennett Jr., particularly his book, The Shaping of Black America, and his chapter on The Road Not Taken. Bennett points out, as does Alan, it's no Garden of Eden. I mean, his conditions were hard, but there was great similarity, and under those conditions, people did what normal people would do. They fought together, they resisted together, they ran away together, they made love together, they functioned as normal human beings, right? So between 1660 and 1676, there were 12 laboring class and bond servant insurrections of varying degrees. The big one was Bacon's Rebellion in 1676 and 1677. And in Bacon's Rebellion, in the second stage, the Civil War stage, when the people at the bottom really get involved, they rise up, they kick the governor of Jamestown out, they burn the capital, the rebels control six, seven roots of the colony for 9 months. Social control is a major issue that the ruling elite has to deal with. And in the final stages of that struggle, the final holdouts are Europeans and Africans in bondage. And you read the account from Thomas Grantham, the fellow who sent the put down, and he goes, "I there met 400 English and Negroes in arms." You see, still not white, right? Another example of that not white concept, John Punch. People may be familiar with that name because about a year ago there was a big hubbub online and, you know, in some of the press about Barack Obama being related to a man who was sentenced to lifetime servitude in 1640 named John Punch. And the twist that everybody was paying a lot of attention to was this relationship was on his mother's side, not his father's side. But what's interesting, there's only one document about John Punch in the records, and it explains how John Punch, who was essentially a limited-term bond servant, and two other limited-term bond servants, a Dutchman and a Scotsman, right, and that's how they're described in the record, had run away. And so there again, you see this notion. These people are not being described as white, not, you know, the word is not in use. The concept, as we know it, is not in use. So getting back now to Allen's analysis, he argues that after Bacon's Rebellion, in the wake of all the labor solidarity shown in that period leading up to Bacon's Rebellion and culminating in Bacon's Rebellion, the ruling elite, for social control reasons, starts to develop this system of extending racial privileges to the European Americans and extending the disabilities to the African Americans, including lifetime servitude, but also, as develops over the next 30, 40, 50 years, also waging attacks on the free Negroes. And this is very important because this is really what marks it as racial oppression, because it's the entire race, if you will, of black people that are subject to oppression. And that's one of the things that differs from what Harrison and McKay and Garvey know in the Caribbean. And let me just step back and explain that. First, let me finish Allen's thesis. So Allen argues that the way they invent this white race is through these racial privileges and extending the disabilities on the African Americans. And the third prong of Allen's analysis, which is very important, is that these racial privileges that are extended to the Europeans, certainly all the African Americans suffer under it, but Allen makes the argument it is also not in the interest of the European American laborers. Certainly the people at the top of society feel they're benefiting from this and do benefit from it, but the laborers, their condition is weakened. The solidarity that had been exhibited, you know, between African Americans, European Americans, and Bacon's Rebellion, you wouldn't see for the next 300 years as this white race develops. So he's arguing the white race is a ruling class social control formation. Let me just say a couple more things about that, and then I want to get back to the difference with the Caribbean, Anglo-Caribbean. Allen says ruling class social control formation because for people who follow the literature nowadays, you may hear often, "Oh, yes, race is a social construct. Everybody knows that, right?" And Allen says, you got to take it further. You really got to analyze how this was done. And he says it's a ruling class social control formation because if you leave it simply that race is a social construct, you're going to leave the back door open for all the Dinesh D'Souzas and the Daniel Patrick Moynihans and all those pseudo-scholars who will argue, "Yeah, but what would you expect from an inferior culture or an inferior family life, but these differences that we see?" If you just say it's a social construct, you leave the back door open for all those white supremacist arguments. You have to, what Allen argues is you have to put it really where it belongs, the ruling class, see whose interests are served by this, and then he develops an analysis for the remainder of U.S. history. Now, to point out the difference between the Anglo-Caribbean, particularly Jamaica, Barbados, and St. Croix, which is where Harrison's from, although it was a Danish colony, English was the language they spoke, and what gets set up there is very similar. But when Harrison grows up in St. Croix, certain things are very different from what we know in the same period in Virginia, and actually a little earlier period. Under the period of slavery in St. Croix, the principal instrument of social control was the militia, which was made up primarily of free people of color. And the reason is this. In St. Croix, you only have 5% of the population is European, 80% of the population are black plantation laborers, and 15% so-called free colored, right? So the 5% seek to utilize the 15% to help to make maintain social control. And it works for a while until, when push comes to shove, the free colored side with the black plantation laborers leads to emancipation things. And you see similar things elsewhere in the Caribbean, and certainly in Haiti and Saint-Domingue. You see a very similar thing, and that's written about by quite a number of people. So the instrument of social control in St. Croix is the militia made up of free coloreds. In contrast, in the U.S., where you have this great, in the U.S., the principal instrument of social control is the slave patrol, which is lily white. And the reason is, it's got to do in part with the demographics and the history of the class struggle in Virginia. But when they create this white race, they're not promoting all these poor whites, if you will, out of the laboring classes. They're still laborers. They're poor laborers, but they're selling them this bill of goods about the white race. So in Virginia and Maryland, you have the majority of the population is European American still throughout all this period, right? So the principal instrument of social control in the Anglo-Caribbean is the militia, free coloreds in Virginia, Maryland, and plantation colonies of the South, lily white slave patrol. Another difference concerns the laws. In St. Croix, where Harrison was born in 1883, but in 1834, they pass an edict, a law of full equality, which at least nominally grants full equality to free coloreds and Europeans, right? Now, in contrast, in the U.S., we have nothing approaching that. We have the Dred Scott decision, 1856, 1857, which essentially says that no black person has any rights that a white is bound to respect. So, again, it's a qualitative difference. In landholding, you see marked differences in the patterns. Harrison is actually born on a plantation that's owned by two men of color. You wouldn't see that in Virginia, right? Because the ruling elite down there is promoting a sector of the African descended population, you know, trying to bring them into the social control structure. One other example, and there's much more could be said about the numbers, but it's rather striking if you think about it. In Jamaica, in the 1830s, on the eve of emancipation, the statistics that Allen cites are that as much as 23% of the enslaved population were owned by people of color. Now, this could be family members and things. That's why, you know, there's much more. But it's still a marked contrast to what we see in Virginia, Maryland, and the U.S. Sorry if I went off on some of this. But what Allen argues is it's a difference between when the white race gets invented, it's invented as a ruling class social control formation. And that's what its function is. That's what its purpose. There's nothing positive in it at all. He says it's the principal form of class collaboration in the U.S. It's the principal device that the ruling class has turned to in periods of struggle, which is what I get into in my work and my talks, how in the 1870s, the 1890s, and very much in the 1930s, when the people at the bottom of society start rising up, U.S. society, and protesting, that these struggles are beat back by conscious ruling elite turns to white supremacy. And the examples from the 30s, I think, are very important, and maybe we can talk about them at some point.
Yes, I would love to, because you have one on the Great Depression and the white supremacist response.
Yeah, and I think it's important for listeners to know about, because we often hear, well, we need something like FDR again, we need a New Deal, you know, and jobs, but it's not quite that simple, because you have to watch what they're doing, you know?
Yeah, they're tricky statements. They're tricky. But, you know, you discussed the it was an issue that I had in mind, definitely about this has just escaped me, and it makes me feel like I'm geriatric right now, because I am. But the formation of white supremacy, and that was what Harrison was just beginning to be able to analyze, what we talk about so prolifically today, was when he experienced how, you know, the Socialist, you know, Party in America, they you know, talking about classism and all of these differentials and privileges and how the aristocracy and the, you know, elites, you know, are manipulating the, you know, the laity, and he stumbled upon, hey, it's something more important here that they're doing that we obviously are missing out on, which is, you know, what you have heightened here, and he's beginning to be how America is keeping this oppression running so tight and
right.
clockwork that
yeah.
we are unable to disrupt it because we don't even understand it. And I would even venture to say, from, you know, reading what you would show from Booker Washington, and when we heard
mm-hmm.
Jimmy Boyce say, those people, to me, understand it. Those people understand it very well, and they write, and they can read them, you know, their writings, how they can talk out of both sides of their mouths. They can say, oh, yeah, you know, it's real horrible. Yeah, they did, and drop some game on you, how they put it together, and at the same time submit and go, you know, do whatever they say. Oh, America, we're not having any problems over there. I mean, Germany,
yeah.
Booker Washington over in Germany, acting like a peer, like just like a codependent abuse victim when someone, you know, ask, like, so abuse women in a relationship, but is that guy hurting you? Oh, no, the relationship's fine. Well, that's what Booker Washington did in Germany. You know,
right.
When
he goes
to
Europe.
Yes, he tours Europe. And by denying the truth, because that's like the Germans don't know what's going on in America. They don't, because they have plantations over here, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So they know. They basically testing to see how this approved Negro leader going to respond when we go to parade him around. To show, look at what we've created. Look at what we've turned this person into. You know, he's no longer effectively a man. He's merely our robot,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so now we're able to analyze it in a much, you know, with all this, you know, 2020 perspective of history. And then we see people today still trying to get their handouts and cookies from
mm-hmm.
the plantation masters by trying to, you know, keep perpetuating the lies. You hear that? Those are the people who are opposing what you're saying, what I'm saying. Hey, go back to sleep. Things are so much better. Woo-wee. Master is great, is the greatest. You know, and that's why I'm glad you, you know, really brought Harrison's perspective and saw how we have been set back some time in our perspective by the diligent work of our enemies who claim to be for equality. They may claim to be promoting, you know, civil rights or, you know, justice and all these issues, but they're really trying to maintain the status quo, you know.
Right. Well, I agree very much with what you're saying, but that's one reason I think that Harrison is growing in importance now, because, you know, he really does speak truth. He paid the price for it, you know, when he was alive, but he speaks
oh, yeah.
truth, and he identifies very clearly a lot of the same crucial issues that we face today. But nowadays, you know, it's possible to get out, you know, more about him. We've got the internet, we've got radio, we've got blog talk radio, exactly what you're doing, because it's, as was in his day, he was reaching to the people at the bottom of society and pushing it up, right, rather than starting at the top. Today, the appreciation for Harrison, I see it because I go around the country or I'm online, you know, I'm in communication with people, and he really is attracting attention. I mean, Arthur Schomburg, when Harrison dies at the funeral, says he was ahead of his time, and he knew how popular Harrison was, but you're going to see, I think, throughout this 21st century, Harrison growing in importance. I see it in terms of numbers of hits on the internet, on the website, on the videos, you know, and just the general discussion. I mean, the younger people particularly are, you know, starting to learn about this and be very interested, you know, which is good, wonderful, I think.
I do too, and I'm glad that you're writing the second volume now. Are you finished writing it?
I've got 1,200 pages written. It's a very big, you know, with a lot of footnotes, and it's going to be people are going to be reading it very carefully, because it's Harrison and the New Negro Movement, which he found. You know, all the history, most people are taught Alain Locke, 1925, but Harrison founds the New Negro Movement 8 years earlier, and he's consistently pushing it. It's going to be Harrison and the Black Socialist. It's going to be Harrison and Garvey. It's going to be Harrison and the Communist. It's going to be Harrison and the Harlem Renaissance. I mean, these are topics which people are going to be very interested in reading about. It's going to be a lot of new perspective coming from Harrison, because it's all these documents, it's Harrison's diary, it's all his body of writings, which most people have never seen before. I think I mentioned last time, also I'm in the process, I'm working right now with Columbia University to put all 800 of Harrison's writings on the internet for free, so people can see, and that'll be part of the effort, you know, to help make him available, so people can read it, you know, in this country, internationally, in the Caribbean, in Africa, wherever, they can read about him, you know, themselves, right, from wherever they are, from their device or their home or their school. And I think will add to his, you know, growing stature, because he's brilliant and he's insightful. So I think it will help. I think it will help in the struggle very much. I think the younger generations in particular will be able to help take Harrison and others, because he was struggling with many others in his era and the issues they raised. But I think the newer generation will be able to really push this stuff forward, you know, take it to new levels, which is what we always hope for, right, as we live and struggle. You know?
Exactly.
People carry it on.
Wow. Thank you. I think we're out of time. Is that correct?
No, actually, we have a few more minutes. You can, you know, wrap things up and talk more about the, you know, his books and how to everything that he's offering on his website, his videos, and all of that.
Great. That's right. Appreciate that. Can you please, Dr. Perry, share with us how people can acquire your writing?
I try to make as much as possible free so people can access it. The key place to begin, I believe, is my website, which is simply my name, www.jeffreybperry.net. If you go there, you'll find all kinds of material. But if you're in the car right now and you don't, or whatever, and you can't write it down, if you Google Hubert Harrison, that should take you to my webpage, or Theodore W. Allen, or The Invention of the White Race. Now, on that website, you'll see down the right-hand column separate sections. One is devoted to one book I did, which is a Hubert Harrison reader, which is 138 articles by Harrison. So you can read him in his own words, as well as beautiful introduction and description of him from J.A. Rogers and other scholars writing about him. And you can have links to about 30 or 40 of the articles right there for free online. And the next section I have is on the book, volume one of the biography, Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918. And you'll go through, again, sections. You can read whole sections of the book, the introduction, which lays out who Harrison is. Across the top of my webpage, you can read comments from all the leading scholars and activists about how important Harrison is and what a giant he is. And I think people will be blown away, and you can read, you know, the Amiri Baraka's, and, you know, you'll see, depending on your interest, but Bill Fletcher, Arnold Rampersand is writing there, Manning Marable, and on, Joyce Moore Turner. Again, it's the head of U.S. labor against the war. Lots of surprising for many. It'll be how wide his appeal is, I think. Underneath on my webpage, after I have those Harrison sections, I have the work on Theodore W. Allen on the invention of the white race. Allen, for those not familiar, did pioneering work on the concept of white privilege. But when Allen writes, beginning in the 1960s, it's a class-based analysis. So it's not all this stuff that you're seeing on the internet today, or if you go to Wikipedia, and it's all this stuff talks about the invisible knapsack in 1986. It's much deeper class analysis. I think people would really appreciate it. One thing about the work I do, the work Alan does, the work I do on Harrison, it's very serious scholarship. There's many, many footnotes. So for your curious and really genuinely interested reader, they can say, well, he's saying this. I don't know. Let me go check the source. And then you'll have the source, and you can go back and look. And Alan puts the opposing views in there, too, and you can read because you want to hear. And he tries to put them in their strongest light so he can really move our understanding forward. Two other things I want to mention about my webpage, aside from articles and those, some of those sections, at the very top of my webpage, on the top left, I have an article that's entitled, and you can just click it and get it for free. It's a big, long article, The Developing Conjuncture, The Developing Crisis, and Insights from Hubert Harrison and Theodore W. Allen on the Centrality of the Fight Against White Supremacy. What I've drawn from both Harrison and Allen is they understand very well the class nature of this society, but they understand that in the U.S., white supremacy is central to how the ruling class maintains control, and there's no ducking or dodging. That's the issue we got to deal with, you know, as we fight this struggle. We got to take them on that. And so this article goes through a lot of that, and it draws insights from Harrison and from Allen. One of the ones that I open up early with Harrison, I may have mentioned last time, but I'll mention again, and then I close the article, is Hubert Harrison, 100 years ago, writes how politically the Negro is the touchstone of the modern democratic idea. And again, that touchstone, this is an extraordinarily important metaphor, I think. A touchstone is a black stone. You take it, you rub it against the metal to see if it's really the gold it purports to be. And I think we can use that in every issue we look at in society, housing, education, incarceration, health care, and so on and so on. How are black people faring, and what are we all, what are we going to do to address that inequality? Harrison goes on in the same paragraph, and in a statement which foreshadows the civil rights, black liberation struggle of the 60s, he says, and true democracy and equality for the Negro implies a revolution startling to even think of. And what he's, I think, foreshadowing, what I think he's accurate on, is that struggle that he's describing is one in the 60s. It was a catalyst for every other movement for progressive social change in this country, the anti-war movement, the student movement, women's movement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's the case because that struggle is so just, and because it hits directly at how the ruling class maintains control. For those of us who want change in this society, that's the issue we've got to take on, I think. And Harrison points it out. Alan points it out. One last thing, if I may, the reading and the talking and all this, but what people may appreciate and may enjoy on my webpage, and you'll find it right from the first page and elsewhere, a number of people have videoed presentations I do. When I go around and do these talks, and I'll talk at high schools and trade unions and domestically and colleges and internationally, when I do the talks, I do slide presentations, and some people have recorded these slide presentations, and some of them are, you know, an hour, 2 hours. So they're pretty interesting, but you can follow right along because there's a slide coming up. And when I'm talking, then you can see, you know, what's being said, and you can just stop it if you want and think about it, you know, or, you know, probe a little more deeply. But the videos are increasingly attracting attention. I think people, you know, nowadays like that medium, and they're using it more and more. So I would encourage people to please, if you have the time, check out the videos. The one on the invention of the white race is each day I'm seeing it's attracting increased attention, so people might want to look at that one.
Great. I've been seeing it because we've been promoting it on our pages, and I saw some other people sharing it out, and I was glad it was getting a lot of response and shares on the
Good. Very good. I want to thank you again, you know, for both having me on, but for helping to get this information out. And I can't stress how important Hubert Harrison is. He's truly a giant. That's how, when J.A. Rogers writes that wonderful piece in World's Great Men of Color, it's Hubert Harrison, intellectual giant and freelance educator, right? And other people, particularly people of his era, knew how utterly important he was. And I think people are going to, you know, increasingly come to that understanding again. The reasons why Harrison is not better known, we can perhaps discuss some other time, because it's unfortunate. It's a sad commentary on a number of things.
I would like to do that and put it directly in context with all these other things, like the Workers' Union, the New Negro, and talk about the suppression of the New Negro that he envisioned, that struggle that he said was, you know, too profound to even, you know, think of or talk about, and put it in that context. We should have that. That would be great.
Great. I would love to.
I'll write that down.
Perfect. Are you coming back next week? Can we look forward to seeing you again?
I would love to. If you would like to, sure. We could go next week, same station.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do that.
Yes.
Same time, same station. Okay. All right. Well, if there is nothing more.
We have everyone tune in next week.
Uh-huh.
And we'll follow up with the topic, the suppression of Hubert Harrison's work over the past century, and the context of the various movements that he put in place with relation to the New Negro.
Perfect. Be sure and go to the website, www.jeffreybperry.net. Do that. Do not hesitate. All right? Good night.
Okay.